Blog Talk Radio.
Today, Florida's Governor Rick Scott signed what the state's legislature had passed, a bill of limited gun reforms. Following that, the National Rifle Association sued. How about that? The NRA is suing a state government dominated by Republicans. Is the world still on its axis? We'll talk about what the law does in just a little bit. The Pentagon was asked if they wanted to do a military parade on Veterans Day in Washington. No tanks, they said. But can we just goose-step like in other countries' military parades? And Toys R Us may be closing down next week. They're the latest phenomenon in the checkered history of leveraged buyouts. We'll explain that a little and tell the story of what happens to companies that are victimized that way. Also, certain toy manufacturers are going to be hurt by this as well, and we'll talk about that. Scott and Mark Kelly. You may remember those names. They're twin brothers, both of whom are astronauts. One of the brothers, Scott, spent a year on the International Space Station while Mark stayed on Earth. NASA wanted to study the DNA, among other things, of the two twins to compare them after the year in space for Scott. It turns out that that much time in space does, in fact, affect the ability of the body to repair itself, and they're continuing to study the twins' different reactions. Twin studies, as you know, have a history that began with the esteemed Dr. Mengele. It's kind of a weird path for NASA to follow. Finally, Michael Cohen, Trump's attorney, apparently violated election law, not because he paid off Stormy Daniels, but because he used a Trump company asset to arrange for the money to pay Stormy Daniels. You remember her. She's the porn star who says she had an affair with Trump and whom they paid $130,000 to keep quiet. Unlike senators, once she was bought and paid, however, she didn't stay bought. Trump denies the affair that allegedly occurred after he'd been married for a short time to the current First Lady, but the payment isn't being denied. Now, maybe I'm nuts. Okay, I'm nuts anyway, but maybe I'm nuts about this. But if someone says they had an affair with you, and it's not true, but they demand money to keep quiet about it, would you pay them? Nah, I'm sure the affair never happened. Mr. and Mrs. America, all the ships at sea, welcome to Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman, that's me. Tonight we'll talk about those stories, tariffs, Russiagate, and if you'd like to call in, you can do that too. I'll give out the number now, though we won't be taking calls for at least a few minutes. The phone number to call in if you wish to is 646 area code 668-2953. Repeating that, 646-668-2953. We'll be happy to take your calls, and if you make some sense, we'll let you continue on the air for a while. In any event, wanted to remind you that if you wish to support the show, you can do that, and it would be appreciated. To do that, you would go to patreon.com/Jeff Bushman, and any contribution you care to throw our way would be greatly appreciated. Also, pardon me. Our books are up on Amazon. We've got three of them, but one of them is called The Mobile Millionaire. The Mobile Millionaire is about investing in mobile home investments. And if you'd like to take a look at that on Amazon, again, it's called The Mobile Millionaire. And while you're there, of course, you can take a quick look at our other books. And again, that would be appreciated. In the meantime, we wanted to talk about those stories, but we also wanted to mention to you again our thanks for those of you who have been joining the show, if not quite in droves, at least in increasing numbers, and from all over the world. Well, okay, not all over the world. I don't think we have any listeners in China, except for that one small city in that country, Hakmira. Some of you will recognize the name of Hakmira, China. Anyway, except for there, we don't have any listeners in China, but we do have listeners in places like Norway and Britain and Canada. Canada is not so strange. I find it hard to believe that we have listeners in Norway, but you're welcome. And if I had thought about it, I would have looked for the phrase, welcome to the show, in Norwegian. but I did not. So welcome to the show. I'm assuming that the people who are listening to this show are speaking English, or at least understand English. And of course, in Britain, they do speak English after a fashion, which is what they say about us. the old saying, with which some of you will be familiar, is that the United Kingdom and the United States are two countries separated by a common language, for what it's worth. Okay, let's talk about some of these stories before we get into the discussion of, and this sounds dull if you talk about what you're going to talk about and you say Russiagate and tariffs. Russiagate is, of course, interesting for a lot of people, but tariffs sound really boring. But we're going to explain some benefits and detriments to tariffs, mostly detriments, not because Trump is suggesting them, but where they can have, outside the issue of a trade war per se, where they can have, what the disadvantages are. In any event, the law that passed in Florida about limiting guns and is now the subject of a lawsuit by the National Rifle Association is something that's worth looking at. One of the things in there that I frankly don't agree with, which will make me sound more conservative than I actually am, they're putting on a 21-year-old minimum age to purchase all guns. And to be honest, a handgun, guns perhaps used for hunting, I don't have a problem with 18-year-olds being able to buy those. I don't want to buy any, but and of course I'm substantially over 18, so that's not going to be an issue for me. But it is my opinion, and that's what all of this stuff is based on, because the truth is nobody really knows how the Second Amendment actually applies to this stuff. They just have their own viewpoints. So it's not a Second Amendment argument. What it is an argument for, however, is the rights of 18-year-olds. Yes, you have to be 21 years old to drink, and having a gun is a more serious issue than having a drink, sometimes anyway, at least if you don't get into a car while you're drinking, or too close in time afterwards. But my opinion is that 18-year-olds can vote, 18-year-olds can go to war. If there were a draft, we were drafting 18-year-olds when we had a draft. My opinion is you ought to be able to buy a handgun or a rifle or shotgun at 18. The 21-year-old minimum age, I would apply, however, to weapons that can fire semi-automatically or automatically. Those are obviously very dangerous, much more so than the other guns. Although if you get hit by a bullet by one of those others, there's a good chance you're going to die anyway. But you can kill fewer people at a time with those other weapons. So I believe they also outlawed bump stocks, which can make a non-automatic weapon into an automatic or semi-automatic weapon. For those of you who are into guns or own guns, you have probably been able to tell that when it comes to guns, I don't know entirely what I'm talking about. And that's fine. But when we're talking about rights and dangers and responsibilities, one doesn't really have to know everything about guns to have an opinion and a determination as to that. But what the law does do is it changes the minimum age to buy any firearm up to 21. Here's the part that I like. Well, first off, there's another element to it. School staff members. Certain school staff members can volunteer to carry a gun on campus besides resource officers, so-called. You also have custodians and principals, but no teachers, which is good. The bad part about that is that if I'm a nutcase who decides to take a gun of any kind to a school, and by the way, the AR-15s and other automatic or semi-automatic weapons were not outlawed by this law, and this only distinction is like with all guns, now in Florida you have to be 21. I don't think you become mentally healthy necessarily at age 21, so I think they should have restricted that, the AR-15 and other similar types of guns. But anyway, that's another story. But the problem with arming or allowing certain people in certain positions in a school to be armed is that if you're a nutcase who comes into the school and you see someone who looks like a custodian or you know is the principal, aren't you going to shoot them first? Even if they don't have guns, you're not going to know that. But you are going to know that they are of the type of employee in the school who might have a gun. Not causing teachers or allowing teachers to carry guns probably has saved some teachers' lives today. But allowing principals, custodians, and others to carry guns makes them a whether they're carrying or not, an absolute target of the nutcase who enters the next school. Just a thought. The thing I like best about this new law is that it creates a situation where if police or other individuals believe that a specific individual is a danger to him or herself or others, that they can go in and get a court order requiring the police to seize that person's guns. And that person can have, I don't understand all of the nuances of this law or all of the procedures, but that person can then go into court afterwards and show that they are sufficiently sane to own those guns. And that's not a perfect solution, but it's a very good step forward in terms of enabling a situation where you realize someone or where someone realizes that someone is a danger, to at least make them less of a danger to members of the public and themselves. And I think that's a fine idea. Granted, a court has to make a ruling on it, and that's fine too. That's some protection for the folks whose guns would be taken away. But at least it gives a measure of safety to the public in that area where the nutcase may be. Okay, and one of the things that people will look at, obviously, is someone's Facebook postings. Because the guy who committed the murder at the school in Florida had posted some Facebook entries that indicated he wanted to go shoot up a school. I mean, it doesn't get too much clearer than that. Okay, moving on. Toys R Us, maybe closing down next week. Toys R Us has been in Chapter 11 two or three times. And they are a company that was a subject of a leveraged buyout. By the way, as a quick aside, having nothing to do with Toys R Us, we may be shutting down the program a little early tonight for a variety of reasons, one of which is we have no guest, and I don't want to hear myself talk that long. So if you do want to call in on anything, do it in the early stage of the program rather than waiting to the end. Most of the people who listen to this program listen to it after it's been recorded, so I may be talking to, you know, six people or something. But of those six, if you want to call in during the show, call in early, because there may not be an opportunity too much later. Okay, Toys R Us story again. So let's first talk about what a leveraged buyout is. This is a very peculiar idea. Some might call it a scheme or a scam, but it's been done for decades. And there are some good situations which involved leveraged buyouts. One of the ones that comes to mind is, I can't remember now whether it's Office Max or Office Depot. Actually, Mitt Romney's company was involved in that. Oh, Staples. It was Staples. I beg your pardon. And what a leveraged buyout is this. These investors come along, and they offer to buy a company with this leveraged buyout idea. And leverage refers to the amount of debt that the company takes on in the process of the buyout. So essentially, let's say that a company is selling for $1 million. Companies don't sell that cheaply, but it will do for our purposes. What will happen is that the investors will come up with, say, 10 or 15 or 20%, let's say 10%. So they come up with $100,000 in my $1 million company. They then use the assets of the company to secure a loan. This is all done through paperwork, and nothing happens until everything closes. But the assets of the company are pledged as security, along with the company itself, to the lender, such as a bank. So the investor puts up $100,000. The bank pays the other $900,000 to the seller. So the seller gets the full $1 million, seller or sellers or shareholders. And the investor who's put up $100,000 now has this company, and they can run it and use the income from the company to pay off the debt. The idea being that the investor will be one or more savvy business persons who will be able to then cut costs and make the company more efficient, and thereby, with the income from the company, easily be able to service the debt and make a lot of money for themselves and allow the remaining employees to continue working and having a job. And sometimes this works, as it did with Staples, although some people did lose their jobs, and some stores did close. But by and large, it also increased jobs after a time because the company was able to expand after the debt was paid and so on. But anyway, that's what a leveraged buyout is. You use the leverage, the debt, to help facilitate the buyout of the selling company, okay? Well, that's what happened with Toys R Us. The problem was is that there were only so many efficiencies they could squeeze out of Toys R Us, that is, so many things they could do to make it more efficient and make more money, and they saddled it with a lot of debt. They saddled the company with a lot of debt to banks. And one of the other problems with that is that just after they did this, the Internet became much larger as an avenue to buy toys. So now, although some people have bought toys through Toys R Us online and in the brick-and-mortar stores, a lot more people have bought through Amazon and Walmart online, particularly Amazon. Although Walmart is the largest seller of toys in the world, is that their online presence is not as strong as Amazon's, but the combination of their online presence plus the brick-and-mortar stores, and you'll understand this if you ever walked into a Walmart sometime after Thanksgiving, you will see all these people buying toys, bicycles, etc., inside the Walmart. So besides being beat up by Walmart, both brick-and-mortar and online, and Amazon online, there just wasn't that much they could squeeze out in terms of making the company more efficient. So they ended up filing Chapter 11, again, over the years several times. And more recently, what happened with Toys R Us is they were having trouble through a Chapter 11, as I understand it, getting what's called debtor in possession financing. When a company files Chapter 11, depending on what's going on, but usually they can get financing from a bank to help pay their debt, and of course they'll also get rid of some debt, but they'll have a plan to retire debt over a period of a few years. And what was happening was they were having trouble getting that financing from banks because they didn't look real viable. The result of that is that shippers, companies, let me also add that financing has priority over all other debts. So what you end up having happen is if the bank will loan the money, again, assuming you need, pick a number, $100,000, and of course these numbers are all smaller than reality, then they'll loan you the money, and when you make payments, you make payments to the bank first and then the other creditors. Well, they were having trouble getting financing at all. And by the way, that's why banks don't mind financing companies in Chapter 11, because they have priority. And if the company ever liquidates, the bank gets paid first. So they were having trouble getting any bank to lend the money in their Chapter 11, not because of the Chapter 11, but because Toys R Us just didn't look viable. Well, when that started happening, and it looked like Toys R Us would not have cash to pay for goods shipped, companies that would sell them product like Lego or Schwinn bikes stopped selling to them because unless they paid in advance. And of course that was the death knell. And so they're going to liquidate probably next week or the week after. And thereafter there will be no more Toys R Us stores. Now that's bad for your kid who wants to go shopping at Toys R Us, and probably bad for you because now you'll have to or maybe it's good for you, I don't know. But I was going to say, you'll have to buy the kids' toys online or at Walmart or something. But Toys R Us, frankly, was a fun store. I remember when my son was a kid, we would go in there and I'd say to him, okay, you have this much of a budget to pick out toys. In fact, a number of years ago, I wrote an article for a magazine about a gift budget. But in any event, the Toys R Us thing is kind of a fun place to go. And the advantage to it is you could go in there and experiment and look at and touch and feel toys or games or various objects, the bow and arrow, the lawn bowling, all that stuff. And now you won't be able to do that. But the manufacturers whose sales rely on that sort of thing, like Lego and bicycles, they're not going to have that outlet anymore. And not every town has Walmarts in them. Oddly, by the way, speaking of Walmart, this may sound like a completely extraneous aside, but it really isn't. Well, I am broadcasting on the 9th of March from Arizona. We have Walmarts all over the place, even small towns, big towns. Where we live in the suburb of Phoenix, we all within 10 or 15 minutes ride, we have like three or four Walmarts. Not talking about the neighborhood markets, but the full store. In Los Angeles, if you live in the main part of the city, there's almost either none or almost no Walmarts. You have to go out to the San Fernando Valley, for example, and then there's one. So it's crazy, and I can't tell you why. I'm assuming there was some opposition from residents to having Walmarts there because they were afraid it would kill small businesses. But whatever reason, it's just very weird. When I go to L.A., there's no Walmart stores to speak of. And here, they're all over the place. So in any event, that's the situation with Toys R Us. So if you grew up running around in Toys R Us or you had kids that you took to Toys R Us, that opportunity is going to be gone. So if you're interested in, you know, getting in the last licks, this might be the time to go visit one. also, we spoke briefly about the twin brother astronauts and the twin studies that NASA has undertaken. The reason this could be serious, I'm not talking about the twin studies and the joke about Dr. Mengele. What I am talking about in terms of seriousness is that we are, not just this country, but a number of countries, are looking at sending people to Mars. Now, the trip to Mars, even if you don't, one view is you send someone to Mars, they're going to spend their lives there. They're never going to come back because it's too long a trip. I'll tell you what I was told about a trip to the moon when I was a kid before we had flown to the moon. But 3 years in space, which essentially is what you're doing until you get to Mars, can be a serious problem, because if your DNA is altered after a year, it would stand to reason it would be altered probably even more after 3 years. And if that affects the ability of your cells to regenerate and to self-repair, that could end up in not with the astronaut who was only there for a year, but the idea about the people who go to Mars, that could result in substantially shorter lifespans and a lot more illness. There is something that happens at the end of, I'm about to get outside my knowledge, but there's something called telomeres, which shorten with aging. And one of the things that was happening was the shape and length of the telomeres of the astronaut who spent the 1 year aboard the space station foretell problems with people who travel for much longer periods of time. So it is of some concern. Obviously, they have more studies to do. So if you're a twin, you may want to hide if you see anybody with a NASA uniform. Stormy Daniels is an interesting story. First off, because it seems to be affecting the president so little. But the story that the administration has told, like a lot of other stories the administration has told, seems so full of bovine fecal matter, it's astounding. I almost said it's incredible, which would be redundant, but it's astounding. According to the story, this fellow Michael Cohen went ahead and paid $130,000 of his own money to this porn star to keep her quiet in the weeks before the election in 2016, to keep her quiet about an affair she alleges she had with Donald Trump prior to that. Well, why? The first question is, let her talk and deny it like everybody else, unless what she has to say is so incredibly believable or so astoundingly believable that it could have hurt Trump. Now, what is it that could have been so astoundingly believable? You had all these women, I don't remember the number anymore, 18, 19 women, talk about Trump having sexually assaulted them, come on to them, been overly aggressive, all kinds of things. He denied it all because it is pure as a driven snow, of course. And unfortunately, he couldn't deny the Access Hollywood tape in which he said he would grab a woman by her genitals and they would let you. Anyway, charming guy. But this one he didn't just deny. This one his friend paid off. Now, why would you even, you know, let's assume you're wealthy and Donald Trump's your friend. Would you take $130,000 out of your own pocket to keep this one woman quiet? None of the others, just this one. Okay? If it didn't happen, and further, I mean, I have to believe that most or all of the other ones happened too. And further, if she wasn't inherently extremely believable, that just, it beggars the imagination. But here's an interesting aspect of that and why she might be uncharacteristically believable. Uncharacteristically is the wrong word. Astoundingly believable. Substantially more believable than the other women. Even though I find them credible and you may find them credible, they felt, apparently, by the denial of the then candidate alone, that was enough to not cause him any harm. But not with her. Okay, and do you first believe that he would have paid out $130,000 without expecting to be paid back? That's nuts. I mean, I've got lots of friends. Of course, I don't have $130,000, but if a friend of mine were in trouble and they asked for $20, I'd probably give it to them. If they asked for $1,000, we'd have to talk, okay? That would be peculiar. And $130,000, in other words, if you take it up quite a level, let's assume Cohn's a millionaire. $130,000 is still a bunch of money. And even if Donald Trump is a great friend of his, why $130,000 to this woman and nothing to any of the others so far as we know? Okay. Well, there is in the agreement that she signed and he did not, which is a whole other legal issue, about which I'm not sure she's right, by the way. But the agreement said that she will not talk about a variety of things, including paternity, okay? And I could be wrong, but it is my impression or belief or assumption that they entered into that agreement and they paid, they being Cohn, possibly Trump, whoever it was that was going to do this, paid the $130,000 because she may have a little bit of evidence that none of the other women had. And it's the kind of evidence that would crawl and drool, and perhaps have a name, okay? Why else would you put into that agreement any question or subject involving paternity? And that alone would seem to justify the $130,000 payment to shut her up. And now they seem to have at least temporarily shut her up with an order from an arbitrator, and her agreement, though she signed it and he didn't, acknowledges that the arbitrator will have the right to rule in cases stemming from the agreement. So it's kind of a weird situation, obviously. But I wouldn't be surprised if there is another little Donald running around somewhere with a really bad comb over. Okay. You're welcome to disagree with me. And again, if you want to call, it's 646-668-2953. I'm not expecting any calls, but if you want to call in, feel free. Okay, let's talk about Russiagate briefly. What's happening in the Russia investigation is, and you've heard about this, obviously, unless this is the only podcast you listen to and you don't listen to any news and you don't read a paper and don't watch television news. And I can't imagine there's anybody like that, but if you're there, welcome to the show. The thing that's happening is Mueller is going up the chain. This is a common occurrence, as everybody knows, who watches any TV, whoever watched L.A. Law or NYPD Blue or anything, any other cop show or lawyer show. What happens is a prosecutor will start with small fish who then turn on their employers or their confederates and testify against them so that you can then move up the chain to the next level of fish, if you will, and so that person will turn. Anyway, that's what the procedure normally is. Well, you've got George Papadopoulos, you've got Rick Gates, you've got Michael Flynn, you've got all these people who have basically provided information to Mueller and his staff. They're not testifying to the House Intelligence Committee because when they already know that when they say, I'm not going to testify about this, not because of the Fifth Amendment, not because of executive privilege, but things like I'm not prepared to answer that, or I've been asked by the White House not to answer that, whatever it is, they know that they're not going to be cited for contempt of Congress, which is the norm. If you are subpoenaed to testify in front of Congress, you either refuse to show up at all, or you say, I'm not going to answer those questions because I don't want to or because I've been asked by the White House, without a claim of executive privilege, which would go to court, or without the assertion of your Fifth Amendment rights, you are in contempt of Congress, just as you would be in a court if you refuse to testify. And the House Intelligence Committee has refused, which of course is dominated by Republicans at the moment, has refused to cite anybody for contempt of Congress. They could have cited Steve Bannon, Hope Hicks, Corey Lewandowski, and I'm probably forgetting somebody, could have cited all of those people who have essentially refused to testify. By the way, now that Hicks has left the White House, there's no longer any hope there, but that's a whole other story. Anyway, the situation, however, is they have now indicted Paul Manafort, the brief campaign manager of the Trump campaign after Corey Lewandowski left. They've indicted him. He's pled not guilty. They've indicted him for things, some of which are related to the Trump campaign and many of which are not. But he pleaded not guilty, as mentioned, just like the Watergate defendants originally did in many cases. Is there anyone on the planet who believes that Paul Manafort will risk going to jail so he doesn't have to testify about Donald Trump? Also, in terms of the Russians and their manipulation or attempted manipulation of our election in 2016, a couple of thoughts about that. It turns out that Manafort and Jared Kushner and Rick Gates were having a lot more meetings with Russians than we already knew about, and which Mueller does know about. And Trump and his lawyers are trying to work a deal right now where Trump will sit down and speak with Mueller or his staff in exchange for an agreement to end the investigation within a certain limited period of time. Guess what? That ain't going to happen, folks. And Mueller's going to keep on going until he gets all the answers. And I expect he will subpoena Trump, and Trump will refuse to testify. And that, boys and girls, is when the fun gets going. It has long been said, and I think we discussed this on the show a few weeks ago with one of our guests or one of our callers, that there is nothing in the Constitution, there is nothing in the law that says a sitting president cannot be indicted. There just isn't. During the Watergate investigation, there was a belief, and I don't know why, there was a belief that suggested that a sitting president could not be indicted for a crime. That's frankly ludicrous. What that suggests is that if the president, by his using his own example when he was campaigning, if he went out on Fifth Avenue in New York and shot and killed somebody, do you mean you couldn't indict him for murder? That's crazy. Clearly, corruption, conspiracy to commit a crime, such as denying people their vote or manipulating votes, doesn't reach the level of murder. But it is a crime, and conspiracy to commit even a misdemeanor is itself a felony. So if that's the case, then I don't see any reason you couldn't indict a sitting president. Now, the question, although I will say that I understand the logic behind that, and the truth is that, as I was saying, if I can get my train of thought back, I understand the logic behind it. And frankly, I'm not sure that what I said, first off, is true legally, but outside of that, is a good idea. That is, shouldn't it be a law that you can't indict a sitting president? Why do I say that? Well, if you can indict a sitting president and run through the whole criminal procedure with them, what is to prevent the opposite occurring of what's occurring now, but with no basis? Here's what I mean. Let's assume for the moment that Hillary Clinton had been elected president, that there had been no Electoral College. By the way, the other day, Sarah Huckabee Sanders said again from her podium that the American people overwhelmingly elected Donald Trump. No, they didn't. The American people somewhat overwhelmingly elected Hillary Clinton. But under our Constitution, he still became president because of the setup of the Electoral College. That's legitimate, assuming there are no false votes in those three states that did the job for him. But that's not the same as winning overwhelmingly. She got 3 million more votes than he did. If anything was overwhelming, it was her popular vote, not his. But okay, leaving that aside. The thing I was starting to say before I diverged is there anyone on the planet who believes that Paul Manafort would go to jail rather than testifying about what Trump did and what involvement he had with the Russians? And he kind of had to know about it. Among other things, he was in desperate financial shape when he volunteered to run the Trump campaign without any payment for it, without any compensation. And then 3 months later, he was in fine financial shape because the banks that he'd been dealing with now suddenly wanted to loan him money so that they could have an advantage with the Trump administration. In one case, a bank that was a small bank loaned 25% of their total lendable capital to Paul Manafort in one transaction. The banks typically don't do that, okay? There was some rumor that the president or manager or something of the bank, some officer of the bank, was promised either directly or subtly a job as Secretary of the Army in a Trump administration if Trump were to win the office, win the presidency. Trump did win the presidency, and that job never came, but Manafort already had the loan. He was made well during his time as campaign manager. And he was into Russia major big time. He originally, well, not originally, but his involvement with them involved his managing a campaign and providing consulting to the president of the Ukraine, who at that time was a Russian puppet. That president was later overthrown and left the Ukraine for Russia, by the way, where he still lives. But Manafort received millions and millions of dollars from that corrupt Ukrainian president before he was overthrown. And because of the pro-Russian activity of that president and Manafort's involvement with him and the Russians, there, who knows what Manafort knows about the Russian involvement in the election and in conversations with Trump. Additionally, you also have other things that are coming out of the Russiagate probe, including the fact that the son-in-law-in-chief met with bankers inside the White House and, surprise, 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 got loans almost immediately after those meetings to the tune of about, $500 million, where, by the way, he couldn't get loans before. Okay? So that's what you've got with what's going on now and recently in terms of the Russiagate probe. It goes on, and one quick note, and then we'll get to tariffs. Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General of the United States, has sued the state of California because the state of California has within it sanctuary cities and has made itself a sanctuary state for undocumented aliens. And what that basically boils down to is Sessions lied and said that the job of Immigration and Customs Enforcement has been made much harder because California is protecting, quote-unquote, illegal aliens. Okay, well, Jerry Brown, the once and current governor of California, who is about 80 years old, I believe, said first off that Sessions was lying. Good. And he also said the lawsuit that Sessions began will last longer than the Trump administration. And I understand that court procedures take a long time, but I think he was saying something else. And I believe he's right, by the way. Okay, everybody's been wrong about Trump, but because of the Russiagate situation, and I would like to suggest that when you talk to your friends, you refer to it that way. I think it'll speed the procedure a little bit. But because of the Russiagate investigation and what's going to be happening with the report that Mueller produces, it's especially if the Democrats win the House and the Senate, but maybe even if they only win the House, we could see a very shortened Trump term. Getting back to the main thrust of our billboard, if you will, let's talk a little bit about tariffs. I could talk for a long time about tariffs, but it would bore the crap out of most of you, and maybe even me. By the way, we will be on again next week, next Friday. So if you're listening either recorded version or the live version, next week, which reminds me, we have a time change to deal with, so I'll talk about that in a minute. Next week we will be on again, and we'll be talking about more things. We're still trying to line up guests, and frankly, because of scheduling, that's been rather difficult, but we hope to do that. In the meantime, next week, as many of you know, Arizona does not follow daylight saving. So when the rest of you switch this Saturday night, Sunday morning coming up, excuse me, you're supposed to spring ahead, set your clock ahead an hour. You will lose an hour of sleep unless you sleep an hour later than you otherwise would, at least under the according to the clock. But if it is now, pick a time, if it is now 8:40 p.m. your time, you are on daylight saving time, it would be 9:40 p.m. your time. Okay, so you spring ahead. But we don't change time here. And since it would be difficult to do the program at 6 o'clock our time, beginning next week, for most of you, we will be on an hour later. And I hope that's not inconvenient. But that means that instead of being on at 9 o'clock Eastern, we'll be on at 10 o'clock Eastern on Friday night. Since most of you don't have to get up on Saturday morning, that's probably not too big a sacrifice. Likewise, we will be on, instead of being on at 6 p.m. on the West Coast, we'll be on at 7 p.m. on the West Coast. If you're in Arizona, nothing changes. If you're in part of the world where none of this makes any sense, there will be no difference. And, of course, you can always listen to the recorded version in the days following our program. Okay, enough about daylight savings. In any event, that's something worth noting. Let's see what. Oh, we were going to talk about tariffs. Here's the deal with tariffs. Trump is imposing, with certain limitations, a tariff on steel and aluminum. In the case of steel, 25%, aluminum 10%, if I have that right. He is exempting Canada and Mexico. Well, guess where most of our steel comes from? It comes from Canada. I'm not sure where most of our aluminum comes from, but that tariff will have relatively little effect, but to the extent it does have an effect, it's mostly negative. Now, I'm not talking about the trade war issue. What I am talking about is something a little different. If you have a 25% tariff on steel, here's what happens. What happens is all steel that comes into this country from other countries, except for Canada and Mexico and what other exceptions may develop in the near future, will have 25% charged on it as, if you will, a tax on the steel. So if you're bringing in $1,000 worth of steel before the tariff went into effect, now it'll be $1,250. Okay, that's going to increase the price of everything in this country that's made with steel. Who does that hurt and who does that help? Well, hard to say for sure, but if cars, which have lots of steel in them, are 25% more expensive, that is American cars, then what you've got is you've got obviously a Toyota or a Nissan that comes in from Japan is going to be not 25% more expensive, because not all steel, but it'll be somewhat more expensive. Okay. Then the next thing that happens is that some weird things happen. For example, if you build a Toyota in the United States, and some Toyotas are built in the United States, as are cars made by other foreign manufacturers, those will not be subject to cars coming in. let me try this a different way. The cars that are made in this country by foreign car makers will have to be more expensive unless they decide to cut their profit, which companies tend not to do, because they're buying steel that comes in from foreign countries, because we don't make a lot of steel in this country. Even if you revivify the steel industry in this country, it's going to take time to get up and running. And the problem with that is that who's going to invest in the expansion of steel plants or the development of new ones when those tariffs could come off any day? Then you're competing on an unlevel playing field again, which is why most steel manufacturers went out of business in this country. So that said, the Toyotas and the Nissans that are made in this country, the who else does that? I think BMW does and Mercedes does. Those will be more expensive. Excuse me. The Toyotas, Nissans, et cetera, that come into this country with steel in them, even if they were made, let's say, in Japan, I forgot to mention Kia and Hyundai, but if they were made in Japan or Korea and they used steel from a source other than the United States and therefore had no tariffs, they were able to be built more cheaply, and those come into the country. Finished products are not subject to the steel tariff. Okay, and he's not putting a new tariff on cars. So what happens then is Toyota logically would make a decision, well, since we can build them cheaper there because we don't have to pay the steel tariff, let's build more cars in Japan, or Kia and Hyundai in Korea. Let's build them there and bring them into the U.S., at a price cheaper than we can sell them for if we've made them in the U.S., and that's going to cost American jobs. Likewise, it may cost jobs of Americans who are working in American car plants, because, again, GM, Chrysler, and Ford have to pay more for steel that comes in. Okay, now, because the tariff has not been fully implemented, you can bet that all those companies are going to buy a lot of steel before the tariff goes in, but at some point it runs out. So they have to pay more. Now, does that mean that they then charge more for their cars? Well, yeah, it could. But it could also mean that if they do charge more, then what happens is they either sell fewer cars and therefore have to fire some workers, or because maybe some foreign cars might be more expensive coming in, or, you know, it's hard to know, very frankly. I mean, I'm mouthing off about this, but the truth is nobody really knows except that certain things will be more expensive here because they're made with imported steel, which is going to be paying a 25% tariff, and some jobs will be lost here, like at the Toyota plant, which is somewhere in the southeastern part of the country, and other car manufacturers have plants here which employ American workers. And so it's going to cost some jobs. Now, will it go ahead and produce more jobs in steel and aluminum? Maybe. But again, that's going to take some time to be ramped up. And so it's kind of a peculiar problem. Anyway, that about covers it. We could go on, but as I said, it'll be really boring. And frankly, as you can tell by my voice, I'm getting tired. So I'm going to leave that there, invite you to call in with comments you might have and on next week's show, even about stuff we covered this week, because I know some of you will hear the show during the week between now and then, because you're going to be listening to it as a podcast. If you are listening as a podcast, we are available to be heard live on Fridays, beginning next week at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, 7 in the West, at blogtalkradio.com/Jeff-Bushman. Bushman, B-U-S-H-M-A-N. So thanks for listening. Somewhere out there, it's probably somewhere in Europe, it's coming up on midnight. So although you're going away, please don't go away mad, and do join us next week. Pretty much same bat time, same bat station, except for an hour later. Good night, everybody.